but they have no contact, and it's not inductor. It's microwave. Excites the sulfur. And they were originally conceived in the 1990s, perfected around 2005, and several of our, like I said, sports parks are using them now to light the playing fields up. You basically need one at each end, and that's it. They're that bright. VE3ZZZ, back to net.
On this, Dick.
Okay, John recognized. And the lighting that they do in sports parks, particularly a baseball stadium, I don't think the lights were turned on. No, the lights were not turned on when I was at Yankee Stadium. The one time in my life in the last 5 years, my brother, who's a big baseball fan, and he's got a box seat at Yankee Stadium. So he sits me in that box seat at that Yankee Stadium one hot summer day, and I watched a bird fly over the stadium, and the bird had a sudden rise as he got to the middle of the stadium, and the lights were not turned on. I did a quick calculation. My brother thinks I'm crazy. I wasn't watching the game from this point of view. I calculated the number of watts of heat being given off by the, let me pick a number, 35,000 human beings sitting in that stadium. It was way beyond the megawatts of the lights if it had been a nighttime game and the lights were turned on. Each human being is giving off roughly 150 watts just sitting there in the seat. And when you got 35,000 of them, I'll let you do the calculation. Lots and lots of watts. So that bird said, wow, where did that thermal come from? It was coming from the heat coming off by the human beings. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. K2RIW in the tech, man.
Good evening, Dick.
Yeah,
Ned here. And Merry Christmas. I was just wondering your opinion. Do you think Basil will allow microwave lighting, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, they will if they don't know it. In the case of the antennas that sit on top of the water tower, that's right alongside of the grade school, that in their mind is thoroughly intolerable. And the lighting, well, most of those lights are not going to be in front of the school. If I know them, they will make sure that that light doesn't appear down School Street, which is where the school is located. But the rest of the town maybe can have them. But yes, they are very wary of RF radiation, and I hope they slowly come around on that. They experienced a lot of flooding, a lot of failure of the telephone systems and whatever during a hurricane. This latest, why can't I think of the name of the hurricane?
Sandy.
Yeah, Sandy. Hurricane Sandy. So maybe they've softened some of their opinions, but I think not. They've been at eliminating all antennas from their town now for 4 or 5 years. I don't think they're suddenly going to give up that battle. Hey, Paul, you brought us a beautiful question, and the time we go back to you. WS2N, and how many of those have you installed in your property so far, Paul? K2LAW in the TechNet.
Oh, well, it was the town of Islip. Put two, and one on the corner, and then one between me and my my neighbor, and then all the way up the block. And they really do look good compared to we did have the yellowish sulfur light. This gives off like a blue haze to it. And like the other fellow was saying, that didn't stall them. Mike was saying they are bright, but they're not glary bright. I mean, you know, if you're driving a car down there, they're not going to shine at you. Maybe like the spotlight types would, but these, you know, they go in the street lights. And they give it a white bluish haze, I guess, to it. It's really nice. They actually give off less light than the other one. What's happening is you have cones and rods in your eyes. It's favoring one over the other. And it's not really favoring the ones that are more sensitive, like the sodium lights or the halogen lights. It's got a different kind of light to it, so they're able to actually use lower wattages than whatever was in there before. So, my main concern was the frequency, because of, you know, being a ham. Let me drop it. And it turns out I couldn't find the frequency for mine, but they make them anywhere between 80 meters and 20 meters, you know, from 2.6 up to 13.5 megahertz. And what these things are, you know, they're round, and if you take, let's say, a round tube and grab a hold of it one on one side, one on the other, 180 degrees apart with your hands, your fingers around it, your thumb and your fingers. If you replace your thumb and fingers with a piece of metal, ferrite metal, and then wrap a toroid coil all the way around it, and then you do that on the other side, and then hook it up to a transmitter, and put out, let's say, 4 or 5 meg, and you put it into this glass thing, completely sealed. As far as the secondary, you mentioned the secondary. These are the primary coils, but there's no secondary coil inside. The secondary, actually, coil is really the mercury vapor that's picking up the pulse every time the frequency changes there. Back to you, WS2M.
CU2CH comment. Whiskey 2 Charlie Hotel. We'll get to you in a second. Turns out your soldering gun is a little bit like that also, Paul. The actual copper tip of your soldering gun is the secondary winding, which is one single half turn. The primary winding with, let me pick a number, 1,000 turns, gets 110 volts. So your soldering gun itself is putting, I'm not sure exactly, but it may be 150 amperes at the 1/10 of a volt or something like that actually goes into that copper tip. That's what makes it get hot. So in many cases like this, the secondary winding of a transformer, in your case of the induction light, appears to be the mercury vapor in the tube. That's the secondary, and the primary is the other winding sound. You said you can buy them at various frequencies. Run that by again, Paul. Can I go out and buy an induction lamp to light up my backyard, and I can tell by way of the catalog, I can buy one at 0.5 meg and 2 megs and 4 megacycles. Can I choose that frequency? Also, you tells us you off-tuned an AM handheld transistorized radio near the lamp, and you heard a lot of noise. How far did you have to back away before the noise that you heard, in your opinion, was an acceptable amount? Give us a little bit of a feeling of how much electromagnetic interference they caused, Paul. Paul first, and then I go over to Charlie Hotel second. WS2N, K2LIW, you got it, Paul.
Oh, yeah, a lot. I went out there before they came on with the AM radio. And actually, one light went on first, and then the other one up the block went on later. You know, they're not on time, but they're on photo cells. So went up to the pole, off to an AM radio, nothing, zero. Light came on, all kinds of noise. And just to double check, I went over to the yellow light that didn't come on yet. Same thing, was no noise. Second half light came on, you know, 5 minutes later. Boy, I mean, that was loud. I mean, I'm holding it eye level, backed off about maybe 5-7 feet, and then it went away. And so, but, you know, yet I got my 80-meter dipole up, 20-meter dipole, and I'm not hearing any kind of noise at all. So I guess whatever it is they're doing is pretty good as far as radio emissions go. I don't know how many watts it is. From what I read with the town of Islip, they're lowering the wattage. Let me drop it. Basically a free program. You know, you got... Well, they started off with 8,000 lights to change in Islip. They needed to do 20,000. And the first, I don't know how much money it was, they didn't say, but it was a grant from the government, from the federal government, I guess. And then after that, then they got a loan from the Power Authority to do the rest of these lights, the other 12,000. Street lights, and the deal is that they don't have to charge the taxpayer any more money for it, because the savings in the electric bill will be put towards paying off this secondary loan that from the Power Authority, whatever it was. So it's really no cost to the consumer, you know, for buying these things or even installing them. it can't be the plus that's going to save power over time. 100,000 hours operating compared to 7 or 8 times better than the sodium lamp. Back to you, Dick.
Wow, 100,000 hours, that's into the number of hours you get for light-emitting diodes. And it's not the light-emitting diode that fails, it tends to be the power supply that feeds it. So that's into that category. Well done. Whiskey 2 Charlie Hotel, Ray, very nice picture you've added, a series of pictures on the QRZ.com of those two handsome guys that are sitting in front of that Valentine decoration-like device. I'm guessing the guy with the purple shirt behind is you, but I'm not sure which is which. Whiskey 2 Charlie Hotel, K2RIW. Go ahead, Ray.
Yes, K2RIW in the net, W2CH. Good evening, Dick. Yes, I did add a bit, and actually the picture of the rigs, I'd have to add my new one here from about a little over a month ago, a Kenwood PS2000, to show at the station. But, yes, she does have a short haircut, but that is my wife in a picture a few years ago at Valentine's Day, which also is her birthday and her anniversary. So that's what that picture is, and that's me behind her. And I just want to add, you mentioned about LEDs. I read recently in the Journal newspaper here that in your shell they're using LED a lot for lighting.
Hi, all.
Including, she's saying hello. By the way, she's Marilyn, M-A-R-Y-L-Y-N, K-C-2-N-K-U, it's her call. Anyway, that they're replacing their street lights with LED lights and LEDs for other purposes. I don't know other places that are doing it, but I've heard they are, so I just want to add that back to you in the net, W2CH.
Very fine to Ray and Marilyn, K-C-2-N-K-O, I think you said, or N-K-D. Can't read my own writing. Glad you brought that to our attention. And I've been in the dark ages, haven't heard about these induction lights. And sounds like the fact that they're contactless lights, that the metal contact that's normally inside of a fluorescent-like tube is the major source of failure. It's the contaminant. Lots of current concentrations going on there. All kinds of fancy ionization phenomena are taking place inside of the mercury vapor that's being excited when it's giving off light. And that ionized high potentials hitting the metal contacts creates contamination. That's why the ends of a fluorescent tube near the end of life turn black, and eliminating those contacts, those metal objects inside, I see that as a huge advantage. In which case, I wonder, is there any failure mechanism left at all with pure mercury inside of a high purity environment inside of the fluorescent tube? I guess the phosphor inside eventually experiences some kind of failure mechanism, particularly if it's under a lot of vibration and some of it flakes off from the glass. But I can see how these things can last 100,000 hours. It's about time I find out about these. Thank you, Paul, Paul, Ray, let's see, Mike, other people are bringing this all to our attention. It's time for the mailbag. So what kind of a mail have we had this week? Kind of curious if anybody mentioned gun safety in your mailbag, Paul. Here we go, John. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the second half.
1 second, Dick, about Smithtown.
Yeah, tell us about Smithtown, Paul.
Believe them out, I'm biased toward Islip because I live here. But Smithtown's doing an LED project. I don't know how far along they are, but they are doing LEDs.
So right now, if you, with what you now know, Paul, and if you were the mayor of Smithtown, would you be voting for induction lighting or LED lighting? They're both a hell of a lot better than the previous. But right now, I think you've got two competing technologies. Do you have an opinion, Paul, as to if they had equal bid on both, which one would you choose? WS2N, K2RIW?
Actually, according to what I read, you know, Singapore is ridiculous with these things. They're really into high production. I think overall cost would probably be cheaper with the induction lighting. You know, you've got probably almost the whole town, I think, done with an Islip. And then Huntington's involved, but I think, I know Islip was the one that led the way on this. This guy Nolan, he's not the supervisor anymore, but he started it a couple of years ago. And I'd have to go with induction lighting. I haven't read enough about it technically to say which one is better. Wattage usage might probably be better, maybe with the LEDs, but I don't know. The only failure point I'm not sure I researched it best I could find would be the board itself, and that holds true for the LEDs. The board maybe might fail, but who cares? They could change out the board, throw another one in, and off you go, and keep the light.
Very good, Paul. Paul, we're going to go to the mailbag right now, but after the mailbag, you do have a space report, quite possibly. A quick question to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
I couldn't find anything new except they sent another crew up to the space station. But, you know, people still have questions. I won't go to bed. I'll stand by anyway. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Glad to hear that. Alrighty. Now time for the mailbag. And once again, John, I'm curious, did any of your mailbag responses this week involve anything to do with firearm safety? KC2WGB, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
KC2WGB with the mailbag. Yes, Dick. In fact, the technical questions this week, I guess because of Christmas, were very slow. I got a couple. But there were about 18 emails on firearms, and the range was from take them away from everybody to arm everybody, including teachers. And it went from one extreme to the other. And most of the people were in the center agreeing basically with, you know, you've been saying and I've been saying, and our opinions on, because they've been listening to the repeater too, and they've been hearing quite a bit about the gun legislation and what was going to happen. So a lot of interesting things were said.
Okay, and whether you use the mailbag time to discuss technical or gun safety, your choice, Paul, so fire away. I said Paul and I meant John. I'm all mixed up tonight. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick. What we'll do is I have one technical question. I'm going to save the, we had spoken 2 weeks ago about a differentiator, a passive differentiator made of discrete components, and then we were going to, integrator, and the other subject that Guy was interested in, this gentleman, was the differentiator. I think we'll save that for next week because I think we're going to be pretty busy tonight with the gun thing and comments from everybody. But there's one question, which I'm interested basically in myself also. Let me let it drop. A gentleman has a 30-inch dish from DirecTV. It's an offset-fed, not center-fed. Now, he wants to know, can he use that at 1 gig? And he doesn't want to make a horn. He'd like to bring up an end connector and have different antennas he could put at the point of focus, maybe a T antenna or maybe a small Yagi that he could build. Do you have any suggestions how he could put that to good use? In fact, he may have two of them. One I think is smaller than the other, but he's really interested in that. He gave me a little drawing on it, so maybe you could give him some tips on where to go with that. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
I just brought up my favorite program, which I've written myself. It wants raw data of frequency in gigahertz, diameter in feet. Okay. I'm going to plug in 1.296 gigahertz. And let's see, 30 inches is 24 plus 6, 2.5 feet, 2.5 feet. Therefore, that dish with 60% assumed aperture efficiency will give
what in the world's going on here. Okay?
I'll say yes to that.
And let me redo it. My calculator is behaving crazy ways this day. Okay. Gain. Okay. A 30-inch dish at 1296 with a reasonable feed horn is only going to have 18 dB of gain. So 30 inches for 1296 is a bit on the small side. Yes, dishes are used above 1,000 megacycles most of the time, although if you can get a 28-foot dish, it'll do a beautiful job on 2 meters and 432. But 2.5-foot diameter dish only has 18 dB of gain. That's assuming you can get 60% aperture efficiency because, and he does have it offset fed. All right, so the horn is not going to give him too much blockage. But a good horn on 1296 is itself, let me think, remembering the one that I built, oh, it's around a foot in diameter or so, a good horn, and that's going to give some partial blockage. I think he's only going to get around 16 dB of gain. A relatively small Yagi on 1296.
Oh. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A relatively small Yagi with about 18 or so elements, 22 elements. A 22 element 1296 Yagi, I'm guessing is going to be in the vicinity of 3 feet long a boom. It's going to be a hell of a lot lighter, a hell of a lot lower in wind load than this 2.5 foot diameter dish. So that dish really is going to start flying at 2.4 gigs and above. 1296 is a little bit low. Very few people use a 2.5 foot dish ham radio wise on 1296. So he's going to get a lot more bang for the dollar in amount of wind load, amount of weight, amount of dollars if you had to buy it with a 1296 Yagi. So, and by the way, that dish will have about a 25 degree beam width. It'll have 25 degree beam width and at best 18 dB of gain. I think you're only going to get 16 dB of gain. So, I'm not saying it's not going to work. I'm just saying it may not be the best approach. I'm just letting you know what I think are the limitations as far as physics are concerned. Maybe I didn't answer the question as you understand it, John. So if so, repose it. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Well, the numbers seem to prove out what you're saying, Dick, and you would know far better than I. And the fact that he's not going to use a horn, that he wants to construct some kind of a coat hanger type Yagi to work with this, I don't even think it would work as well as a receiver as he thinks it's going to work, never mind a transmitter. And I have basically the same dish, and I was wondering what I could do with it. It's been sitting here in the lab, and I never thought of playing around with it. But that's a good thing. Now, just to make sure I'm not making a mistake, that would the reciprocity would apply to reception also, correct?
It sure does, John. One of the most universal laws of antennas is that, with the exception of an antenna that contains some kind of a quasi-active device, if there's a preamplifier in the antenna, or if there's a circulator in the antenna, or a mixer in the antenna, anything that's quasi-active, I'm calling a circulator quasi-active, as long as it doesn't have any quasi-active devices, if it's a truly passive antenna, then the laws of physics, going back to the bedrock of the antenna science, say that the law of reciprocity will hold. That means whatever parameter you measure on transmission, that could be efficiency, main lobe efficiency, front-to-back ratio, beam width gain, side lobe levels, polarization, polarimetry, anything you measure on the antenna in the transmit mode, it must have the exact same amount of performance on every one of those parameters in the receive mode. A truly passive antenna is sort of like a 50-ohm resistor. If I take a 50-ohm resistor, I'm using it as a dummy load, and I ground the big end, and I don't ground the small end connected to the center conductor, and I reverse the resistor, nothing changes, if you know what I mean. And most RF capacitors, the same thing. You can reverse it, nothing happens. Well, in the case of a antenna, let me drop antenna be used for transmission.
It's going to have the exact same gain and beamwidth and everything else on reception. And so I think you're going to get around 16 dB of gain. I can give you 16 dB of gain over isotropic with about 14 element Yagi. And to feed this with a Yagi-like structure, that's not so recommended. Most offset-fed dishes need a, what's the word I'm looking for now? I'm trying to remember how we rate. Yes, most offset-fed dishes appear to have a 0.6 focal length to diameter ratio, F over D. That means you need a rather narrow beamwidth feed horn. Most primary fed dishes, where the horn is directly in front of the middle of the dish, most of those dishes are around 0.35 focal length to diameter ratio. In other words, the angle from the feed horn's point of view that the dish subtends is a great big angle, something close to 90 degrees. Whereas a offset fed dish requires a much higher gain horn, a 0.6 F over D as opposed to 0.35. Much longer focal length, so to speak. Let me drop. So by the time you create that amount of gain in a Yagi-like structure acting as the feed horn for this dish, you're almost at the point where you just take that Yagi-like feed horn structure, turn it around the other way, and aim it at the target. Use it as the antenna. You're going to get almost the same gain. I think when we work out the mathematics, let me think about that. 0.6 F over D, that might require a 16 dB gain horn. I think it does. The gain of the feed horn at 1296 and the gain of the dish at 1296 might be the same within a dB or so. Do you see where we're going here, John? So as an experiment, you can definitely do it. It's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to explode. It'll work. But once you understand where the minefield is, where the laws of physics are on this one, I don't think it's the recommended approach. Do it as an experiment. It'll teach you something. But as a desired permanent installation, it doesn't strike me as the best way to go. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. Well, I like your recommendation because I know exactly what he's thinking with this. I know he's going to put it on a mast with a rotor. And when you're looking at that wind load compared to a 14-element Yagi or 12-element, there's a big difference. I think you might have a problem with that. Okay. And if I may, I got one quick one for a very young ham.
You have permission to go to at least two more. It's up to you, John.
Okay. Dick, this youngster is asking, pretty bright, is there an element, a metal, or some type of fabric or whatever, that does not absorb or pass RF energy, but only reflects it? He wants to build an RF bottle. Is it possible?
So give me a couple more words as to your interpretation of an RF bottle. In other words, it does or doesn't reflect, it does or doesn't absorb. There's also some laws of reciprocity here when it comes to anechoic material that you line a chamber with. So what is he trying to do with this RF bottle? What does he want the RF to do when it hits this substance, this magic substance that we're about to suggest to him? I need a few more words, John. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. All right. The substance the bottle will be made out of will not absorb any energy, any RF energy. It will only reflect RF energy. And he wants to make a bottle that he can put RF energy into it and cap it. Is it possible?
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely put RF energy in that bottle. Put the cap on the bottle. Keep the RF energy in there. You can definitely do that. There's a catch. It'll only stay there for a few nanoseconds. By definition, RF energy is a dynamic thing. Your microwave oven is a beautiful RF bottle. It's a completely closed, six-sided, highly conductive chamber. With a modern-day microwave oven, That magnetron tube has got a little bit of a probe sticking into that oven. The magnetron is issuing something in the vicinity of 700 watts of RF energy output from that magnetron tube in your microwave oven. It is launching 700 watts into that, let me pick a number, 2 cubic foot chamber. The chamber itself is made out of highly conductive metal. It absorbs nothing. The RF energy is a dynamic thing. It must be continuously moving. Let me drop. It's a little bit like the breathing mechanism of a shark. If a shark stops swimming, his breathing mechanism stops breathing. He starts choking to death, so to speak. A shark must continuously move in the water. That allows the water to continuously move through his mouth, through his gills. His gills absorb the oxygen, and he stays alive. He's got to move. The RF energy must move to be real RF energy when it's in free space. So what's going on in your microwave oven is that continuously moving microwave energy is bouncing back and forth across every one of those six walls. Every possible bounce you can consider is taking place. The energy inside that microwave oven, in theory, bounces forever. And the only thing in there that's absorptive is the water that's in your food. The water absorbs the energy on each individual pass. If you put nothing in the microwave oven, the klystron tube thinks it's looking into a short circuit. It might. I said klystron, it's magnetron. The magnetron tube thinks it's looking into a short circuit. It might fail. It might not. And even if you did that, the instant you turn off the microwave oven, even before the power supply gets a chance to decay from, let me pick a number, 8,000 volts down to zero, even before that happens, those microwaves in there have already bounced 50 times. They've decreased a little bit in strength on all 50. And within the first couple of microseconds, it's essentially all gone. So, yeah, you can put RF energy in the bottle, but you got to use it within, let me pick a number, 50 microseconds. You can't age it like wine, John. You're not going to put the year on it and open up the cork some number of years later and let the RF back out. We can have some fun with this one. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. Good question.
Yes, and from such a young, I think he's 12 years old. Yeah, 12 years old. And it would be nice to be able to store an RF message and open it up a year later and hear the same message. So now let me see if I understand exactly what's happening. So if the microwave is empty and we fire it up, now we have all of this radiation bouncing around inside. Okay, the magnetron does not go bad. We turn it off. All of that has to disappear as heat, I would assume. Is that correct?
Let me drop. There's a sort of a yes and a no to that. You could call it heat, and you would think that the walls of the microwave oven are going to get hot. Now, with good design, those walls always remain ice cold. The magnetron tube, which has got this little probe behind a plastic barrier, you open up the little plastic barrier, you can actually look at the probe of the end of the magnetron. That probe sticks into the microwave oven, probably half an inch. That launches a signal into the microwave oven. If I'm now sitting inside the magnetron tube and I'm studying what happens, that probe is an antenna launching a signal into that microwave cavity that you and I call microwave oven. That antenna must obey the law of reciprocity. However it transmits, it receives the same way. Your next question is, if I put absolutely nothing in the microwave oven, and it's spotless, surgically clean, where's the load? The load is the magnetron, because that antenna is bathed in that very strong magnetic field that the magnetron has launched into the microwave oven. The probe receives the energy right back. You make the microwave oven thoroughly empty. The magnetron tube says, I see an infinite standing wave ratio. That's a fancy way of saying that the reflected power ratio is 1.000. It's actually 0.99999, but you know what I mean. All of those 700 watts launched into that oven. every one of those 700 watts, 699 of them, come back to the microwave tube, the magnetron. The reason you might burn up your magnetron is it used to issue 700 watts of RF output. It now must absorb 700...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The tube itself tends to run, let me pick a number, 85-90% efficiency. So you put 850 watts, I'm not sure the exact number, you put 850 watts of DC power into that magnetron tube, he issues 700 watts of RF energy. He dissipates, in my example, 150 watts. You now put nothing in the microwave oven, and he must dissipate an extra 700 watts. He must now dissipate all of the 850 within the laws of physics of conservation of energy. So the load of the microwave oven is the tube in that example. Now you see why it's so undesirable to run a microwave oven empty. By the way, this young guy has asked another, he's asked an extremely interesting question that's parallel to one of the questions that was asked at the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. I'm a member of the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, which has their meetings the very first Wednesday of every week, every month, the first Wednesday of every month at Briarcliff College in Old Bethpage. At 7:30 at night, you go there as a guy off the street, and you can sit down in the large room, as it's called. Let me drop. They welcome people off the street who are technically interested. You sit there and listen, and you'll say, wow, the price is right. I'm finding what real consulting engineering is like. These guys are teaching each other how to run their consulting engineering business. And it's open to the public. You're welcome to go there. And if you're electronically interested, you'll love it. And so one of those guys, one of the prominent members who happens to be a computer scientist, and I claim to be the RF maven in the house, he walks up to me one day and says, my wife has asked me this question, and that is, when I blast my food, when I nuke my food in the microwave oven, how long must I wait for the microwave energy to die down in the food? What's the half-life so that my food is now safe to eat? So I take it out of the microwave oven. How long must I wait so the food is safe to eat because of RF energy? And I told him about a nanosecond, maybe 5 nanoseconds. And he looked at me kind of funny because he knows what a nanosecond is. I said, that's how long it takes for the RF energy in the microwave oven with your steak in there, with your hamburger, for that energy to bounce back and forth and to be dissipated and all absorbed by the food. In other words, you can't turn the engine, the microwave oven on fast enough. You can't open the door fast enough. And it's not the food that's irradiated. This is not nuclear energy. It's RF energy bouncing back and forth in there. And how long does it take for that bouncer to go down to the 10% decay point, if you know what I mean? It's nanoseconds. I told him not to worry. And it's a misunderstanding of the word RF radiation. It's not radiation, even though the words say so. It's a vocabulary problem. You see the similarity here between what your very progressive young electronic engineer has asked versus what these...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
This particular computer scientist probably has 30 years of experience in the world of computers and electronics, but not necessarily in microwaves. Therefore, he asked what he thought... He's repeating what he thought is a very logical question of his wife. KC2WGV, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, that's a great answer, Dick, because now we even understand reflection coefficient even better. Without a load in there, it's all being returned, similar to an antenna. In the RF world, without microwaves. So at least he has a good idea of what's going on there. Perfect. Okay, I think we should go on the ball with this report, and then we'll get into the gun issues if you wish. KC2WGB.
Most of us know what a quarter wave ground plane antenna looks like. We've got a good mental picture of it. We've seen them in the backyard. You put down a whole lot of ground plane radials. You put that quarter wave resonator up, a radiator in the middle of it, with the right kind of impedance matching device if need be. you launch that signal and get transmitted. If you now look inside of almost every waveguide horn antenna, that little probe inside is a quarter wave ground plane antenna. It's just the microwave version of it. The one that you put in your backyard that you tune to the 40 meter band happens to be 32 feet high. The little probe that's inside of your X-band horn happens to be 3/8 of an inch high. In both cases, it's electronically a quarter wavelength long. There's some capacitive loading and whatever going on inside the horn, but it is a quarter wave ground plane. So everything that you think is a microwave antenna is the thing that you're very familiar with. Your waveguide to coax adapter is a quarter wave ground plane probe inside of that piece of waveguide. It's the exact same thing in your backyard. It's just been scaled down by 1,000 to 1 because the frequency is 1,000 times higher. Ain't that crazy? You sure you don't have another one you want to go to, Paul? I mean, John, here we go. KC2WGB, K2LAW, you got some good ones tonight.
Let me just check the list, see if I did write another one down, because it was very light this week.
If you want, you can take your sweet time looking at those, John, while I go over to Paul, because Paul sounds like he's got a fairly brief space report tonight. WS2N, K2RAW. Go ahead, Paul.
I really didn't have much. The Expedition 35 crew went up to the International Space Station. Not up to 6 again. They'll leave it that way. And I'm actually waiting until another year or so from now. They're going to send a crew up, and one of the people is going to be Mark Kelly. Scott Kelly, the brother of the other astronaut that was married to Gifford, congresswoman that got shot in Arizona. So, Scott Kelly is going to go up for a year, and that should be, noteworthy when he comes back anyway. He won't be the first one to spend a year in space, but he'll be probably the first, the first American. The Russians have done it a couple of times. And this is to research long-duration space flights to eventually go out to the asteroids or even to Mars. They want to see how we do. But, that's the standard crew now on the International Space Station is always 6. But they'll bring 3 back, and then usually about a month later they'll send 3 more up. So that's pretty much it, Dick. I didn't really have much else. Not much going on right now. Let me drop it. The commercial space business is still going full blast. So we'll wait for another flight for the Dragon. And that should be in a couple of months. And then eventually, they were supposed to have a flight at the end of this month going up from Wallops Island in Virginia. And that was by Orbital Sciences. They're going to launch the Antares rocket with a dummy capsule on top. They just want to test the rocket itself. And this is another private company that's going to be sending supplies to the International Space Station. They got a little delayed, and it looks like they'll probably go up maybe next month. And then once they do that, give it about another month or two, they'll send up the Cygnus spacecraft on top of that. They'll do an orbital flight, and then a couple of months after that, they'll be actually flying to the space station itself with supplies. And so they all have two American companies participating. Back to you, Dick.
One of the interesting things that goes on with the International Space Station almost every month or so is that they schedule a conversation, so to speak, with a high school somewhere in the United States and sometimes in foreign countries. So the Peconic High School and the Smithtown High School and the Ward Leonard High School and so on, from time to time have had a chance to talk to the astronauts directly. The local ham radio operators will set up 2-meter equipment capable of sending a signal up to the sky, and the International Space Station, once you know its Keplerian elements, in other words, the all the parameters by which you know its altitude and velocity and angles and whatever, you know exactly where it is. So what I'm getting at is that the International Space Station, you know exactly where it's going to be some number of weeks and months from now, therefore you know exactly which high school is going to be over, and therefore you can schedule that particular high school to have a conversation with the astronauts. And so from my point of view, it's a very effective way of giving some space enthusiasm to our high school students. Therefore, some number of the astronauts at every instant of time, to my knowledge, are ham radio operators. Do you have a guess, Paul, of the six astronauts that are either there now or will be there in the next week or so, how many of them got a ham radio license and happen to know? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, most of them do. So I don't see why you don't. I haven't read that. Nobody has them. Everybody that goes after Russians, they always have somebody that... They have two ham stations up there. They used to do that years ago. I haven't heard that they do that direct. The school does not... ...to go over. They're all linked through the internet to Houston. They transmit their signals from the school up to the space station that way, so they can have longer QSOs instead of just a, you know, 6-minute flyby. That's pretty much the way it's been done for a long time now. Back to you.
Sounds good, Paul. I guess I was tuning around one of the internet conferences or internet locations in the last couple of days, and I ran into this little article by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the guy that has Nova Science Now, I think is the name of the PBS program. He's also the leader of the so-called Hayden Planetarium, Rose Center, as it's now called, in New York City. And somebody had asked him, what is the most exciting thing that he knows about in astronomy right now? Something like that was the question. And he gave an answer that was very different than anyone would have expected. What's the most exciting thing in astronomy, or astrophysics, or the most exciting thing about the galaxy? I'm not quite sure how the question was answered. I never would have guessed the answer he gave. Let me drop... His answer was the most exciting thing is the elements that makes up his body. That there's lots of evidence that after the Big Bang, the main thing that existed in the whole damn universe was a whole lot of hydrogen and a little bit of helium, but almost all hydrogen. So those clouds of hydrogen gathered together and became stars and galaxies. And if the star was big enough, the star itself, in the process of running its nuclear fire in the center of the star, at tremendous pressures and tremendous temperatures, millions of degrees Kelvin and millions of atmospheres of pressure in the center of a really big star, if the star is big enough, the star synthesizes out of hydrogen and helium all the other elements, or at least the majority of the elements of the periodic table. So those other elements, as the star goes near the end of life, when it burns up all of its hydrogen, and starts making it into helium, and starts burning up its helium and making it into lithium, it starts climbing the elements of the periodic table. If the star is big enough so that it becomes unstable at the end of life and becomes a supernova, it takes all of those elements and blasts them into space. Those elements get blasted into space, that becomes another cloud that eventually becomes the raw material which starts making other stars, other solar systems, and other galaxies. So the stuff that his body is made out of, your and my body is made out of, is either the second or third generation of previously exploded, massive, highly dense stars. That's the raw ingredients that you and I are made out of. We are space stuff. And it was all synthesized in a star somewhere, some number of billions of years ago. He says that realization, is about the most exciting thing that he knows of in astronomy.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm not sure about the exact way he words it, but that's the most exciting thing he knows about in astronomy, astrophysics, galaxy studies, whatever. You probably heard that before, but maybe you didn't hear it worded quite that way, Paul. Maybe you've seen that Neil deGrasse. It's about a 3-minute interview. Very well done. So I wonder if you've seen that one. WSQN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Paul Sagan used to say, we're all made of star stuff, KC2MDP.
Very fine, Steve. And Paul, I will go over to John in a second. Paul, I wonder if you've seen that Neil deGrasse one. Very well done. And I'm not doing a good job of quoting him. You got it, Paul.
I didn't see that with him. Yeah, he is very good. And I like him because he does, to me, he's like the Carl Sagan of today, because he gets on a lot of TV shows. He gets the young people excited about astronomy and science and space. Carl Sagan had that ability as well. And, Sagan used to talk about the star stuff, talked about the stars collapsing, and then the hydrogen turns to helium, then collapses when the star dies out, and it changes to carbon, and then the bigger stars, of course, they have no way to support the gravity collapse, and they get iron out of it, they blow off, they smash into each other, and the atomic elements keep going all the way up the chart, you know. And, to think that 103 different elements somehow gotten here, that's pretty amazing. But no, I haven't heard that one from him. I would have probably guessed, the gamma ray burst or something like that. Back to you, Dick.
I'm with you, Paul. I would have guessed something along those lines, too. I would have guessed, in the case of gamma ray bursts, we haven't the vaguest idea how big is the biggest one. Every gamma ray burst detector we have ever built and put into space, and we keep building bigger and bigger and bigger ones. You wait long enough, another gamma ray burst comes along that saturates that detector. There's some really big bangs that go on out there that will saturate anything you got. And if any one of those takes place within 20 light years of where you're living, the amount of energy of one of those gamma ray bursts will cook everything on this planet in milliseconds. From time to time, Mother Nature can do some really potent things. There appears to be almost no limit. Hey, John, what do you want to add to all this? And I'm going to try to find that that beautiful website again and put it on Bernie's notice on his bulletin board so that we can all look at it, because I think it's worthy. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
QSLW with a comment?
SLW and Wes recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. I did find another question, Dick. This is something only you and I would probably know about. That's all it is. But another interesting comment about that conversation you were listening to. You know, they explained how the different stars, you know, maybe there's one out there that's all diamond. It depends on the size of the star and how it starts to collapse. But basically, the average ones, as they go to burn iron, which is their last stroke, that's when they usually go nova. And when they do a supernova, that's where their very heavy elements are created. And that's why they're sort of rare. So it is a process, but it's a multifaceted process. They don't all go the same way. So I found that fascinating. And it's a long time learning all this stuff and putting it together event by event. It's how they collected this, assimilated all this data, just fantastic.
Okay, you said you did have another one. Let me pick up John first. N2SLW, I think has got a question on this. Go right ahead, John.
Okay, thank you, Dick. No, it wasn't a question. It was more of a statement or some information. Your early generation stars that aren't too large, that manufacture elements up to and including iron. When they explode, and I was interested in some SETI, so I sort of read on this this topic extensively. When the star explodes, you have liquid water in the area around where the star was, and the area is completely, because of the radiation, the area is sterilized. You've got hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, so you're forming RNA. The water starts to cool and forms ice, and you've got RNA inside ice asteroids with iron, and they can, so the RNA will live in there, if you call that living, for a billion years. And that's back to the net.
The big chemistry set in the sky is what you're discussing, John. And it's another example of one of those universal laws of physics, which says that if you have enough material interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. So you take all the raw ingredients on this primordial Earth, wait long enough, amino acids form. The amino acids eventually go to higher and higher forms, and eventually you've got single cellular life, and it starts climbing the evolutionary scale. It's a sobering thought, though, that of all the living organisms you see on this planet right now, lots and lots of plants and insects and animals, and by the way, there's more mass of insects than there are human beings, but there's a lot of living stuff on this planet. And you think that, hey, you take a snapshot in time and this is what there is. It's hard to believe that 99% of all of the plants and animals that have ever lived on this planet are now extinct. You're looking at the remaining 1% during this particular epoch in time. That's a sobering thought. We're the last 1%. We're the stuff in the bottom of the barrel. The valuable stuff. Good to the last drop. West, WS2N, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIWN, space stuff. Go ahead, Bort West.
Yes, Jim, you have mentioned gamma rays. There was a time when I picked up the subject of cosmic rays, and you mentioned that the energy of those rays is very small. Well, cosmic rays are pieces of atoms flying through the space at incredible speeds, and sometimes they hit the Earth, and some of them even hit you. So about 30 cosmic rays fly through your body every second, in fact. So they are not really rare. Also, I want to clarify that what I said about incredible speeds. Although there are several known sources of the cosmic rays, the most energetic cosmic rays detected have been found to travel at about 99992 69 and 5 of speed of light. Let me drop. Now, it may seem that this is just a number, but the problem is that the faster the NNO process could possibly launch a particle, we, in fact, would have taken 40 million times more energy than our most powerful particles accelerator could do, can pick back the atom for those particles to reach their speeds. So, not nuclear fusion in the sun, not exploding stars, if they come from the black holes or colliding galaxies. The question is how. Another question is, if we're talking about the speed of the particle with its mass, we're talking about kinetic energy. That kinetic energy is incredible with that speed. So when I was trying to disintegrate over the spark jumping from point A to point B at a high voltage and being accelerated through the cosmic ray, at least that's what I know from the theory, when avalanche start, and you oppose that this energy is extremely small, we're talking about 10 times